This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, April 16, 2021. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. And Taylor was really nice yesterday. I was really happy for Brian Helgeland, who, of course, wrote and directed the movie 42. And he was our guest for the podcast yesterday. Really happy for him that there was such great response to you know, all the stories that he told about making that movie.
Never a doubt that I thought people would like it, but the emotional response that we got, you know, people tweeting us saying they were tearing up, you know, at work or in the car, that was it was pretty stunning to see. So I'm happy for him. He was happy about it. He sent us a nice note and thanked us for our time. While I was thanking us for his, I mean, 30 minutes spilling stories like that. That was a nice treat for us and the listeners.
Yeah. And it felt like we just touched the surface. Like I had so much more that I would have loved to have asked him, you know, and for example, about Pee Wee Reese, who I got to meet when I was 11 years old, you know, do the background and what he learned about Pee Wee Reese. And I wish I had asked him what his dad thought, you know, after the movie came out, because he was talking about it, his dad was an old Brooklyn guy, what his dad would have thought about, you know, sort of the how Ebbets Field, for example, looked in the movie. Yeah. That would have been cool. Maybe next year we'll get Brian back on and we'll tell even more stories about that movie making progress. Fernando Tatis Jr. took batting practice yesterday and the Padres are optimistic for a return today. Here was Jace Tingler, manager of the Padres, giving an update.
As far as Tatis, he took a live BP today, probably had his best day today as far as the at-bats. And so just a couple of things we got to go over, get with our medical team and things like that. And we're, you know, optimistic that he's got a good chance to be ready to play tomorrow.
And of course they play the Los Angeles Dodgers. This is the series that every, it seems like all summer long will be the series that we all look forward to the most. And there are a lot of questions about his injury. We're going to be talking about that with Carl Ravitch coming up. Cubs reliever Ryan Tepera was suspended 3 games for throwing behind the Brewers' Brandon Woodruff. David Ross, the manager of the Cubs, also received a 1-game suspension, which he will serve today. Let's get to the good stuff. My goodness, the Diamondbacks jumped all over former Diamondback Patrick Corbin.
And a fly ball to right, sending Soto back. He looks up, and it's gone! Andrew Young, a grand slam into the bullpen in right field, and the Diamondbacks lead it 10-3.
That from Arizona Sports 98.7 FM. That was the second inning. At that moment, Patrick Corbin had registered 4 outs and allowed 10 runs. And I was texting back and forth with town evaluators and other teams, and their feeling is right now he just does not have much stuff at all, not very many weapons as he's pitching for the Nationals. Ronald Acuna Jr. seems like every game he does something great, and he did it again yesterday.
First pitch swing, high fly ball left field. Dickerson going back to the warning track. That ball is gone. A majestic home run for Acuna. And just like that, the Braves are back in the game.
Chip Carey on the Braves television network. Yeah, the Braves looked like they were going to lose again. It would have been their 5th consecutive loss. They were playing the Marlins. But in the bottom of the 9th inning, they rallied. Acuna had a single in the middle of that. This is what happened at the end.
The pitch by Floro. Outside ball 4, he walked in the tying run. Stretch by Floro, first pitch. Line drive left field, there's a base hit, and that's a game winner. Dansby Swanson on the first pitch he saw, knocked it over short into left. Acuna scores the winning run, and the Braves answer back. Marlins rallied for 2 in the top of the 9th, and the Braves get 2 of their own.
Mr. Clutch, Dansby Swanson with the big hit late in the game, 680 the fan with that call. Last night I was watching the scoreboard and I saw that the Dodgers had fallen behind and your thought is, no, don't worry about it. They'll come back. And they did.
Digs it out, flies it to deep center, way back there and gone.
Some flexibility in that diet too. Boy, there's some X factor right there. Stays closed, but the hips just open up. And then when the lever system unwinds, it is a missile.
Joe Davis and Oral Hershiser in the Dodgers television network. The Dodgers wind up winning again, 7-5. Making Moves is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. Build your winning team today. Go to linkedin.com/sports. And when you talk about making moves, how about the Dodgers? They won the World Series last year. They added Trevor Bauer. They have this incredible core of young and improving players, and they are just obliterating teams early this season. They're 11-2 and have a plus 34 run differential. Amazing. Making Moves is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. Now, before we get to Carl and Bob Kendrick, who's going to tell us some Jackie Robinson stories, and Todd Radom with the weekly quiz, which I have come to dominate. Sorry, Taylor. Baseball is back, and so are your favorite teams and players. Catch the best of the bigs all season on ESPN Plus with more than 170 live MLB games featuring every star and every team in the league. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com/baseball, and the fantasy baseball season is underway. That means fantasy-focused baseball with Eric and Tristan is a must-listen for all fantasy baseball managers. Follow fantasy-focused baseball wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
All aboard. It's the Rabby Train with Carl Ravitch.
Carl Ravitch, the Rabby Train. Rabby, where are you going to be next week?
Oh, RBO, we have a great week coming up. We got a little radio activity on Saturday, you know, leading into your game. So we got the National Braves Cubs game Sunday, of course, baseball tonight, leading into the Braves Cubs. Two games next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then please don't even ask me which games they are because they all blur together. And then a week from Sunday, Dodgers Padres radio national broadcast. So a real good week for the Rabbit Train to be rolling around Major League Baseball. Really looking forward to it. Feels like we're kind of now moving into the season, which is great.
Yeah, we're getting into the rhythm, unless you're the New York Mets, who've had all these rainouts and are apparently running into bad weather in Colorado this weekend, but we'll leave that alone. The big series this weekend, everyone's going to be watching tonight, the Padres and the Dodgers, and everyone wondering about Fernando Tatis Jr. It looks like he's going to be activated for tonight's game. I have my fingers crossed, and I'm also worried. What about you?
I think so. And, you know, it's interesting because the guy that plays next to him, Manny Machado, you remember, Buster, a long time ago, had those knee injuries and ultimately had surgery. And I remember sitting with him once during a spring training after the knee surgery, and he said, I have the same problem in my other knee. They've told me that it's only going to be a matter of time until my other knee needs surgery, which thankfully I don't believe ever happened. So in the case of Tatis, he could look to his right and ask somebody who has been told, yeah, it's just not great, it's likely going to need this, or yes, you will, and you will have to have that surgically taken care of. It's so hard to see a injury that is a non-contact injury and think that he's going to be okay. And again, maybe Tanaka's another example of it where you just kind of were always waiting for, when is that elbow, when is it going to go out? When is he going to have surgery? And obviously he's back now, you know, playing in his home country and not playing here, and you're not having that conversation, and he avoided surgery and had success. But absolutely, there is skepticism in this house, mine, about the long-term sort of viability of Tatis's injury. No doubt about it. I would worry about it. And it's one of those things, as you know, God forbid, it's like a pitcher who flexes his elbow and then throws another pitch and you're holding your breath. Like, is okay. It looks like he's okay. Every time he's going to swing, are we going to worry that something's going to pop on him?
Yeah, and his situation reminds me of, remember in the NBA playoffs a couple of years ago, remember Kevin Durant was having those calf issues. And thinking, you know, you can go and shoot and feel okay. Fernando Tatis Jr. can go and take batting practice and he can feel ground balls. But when you throw in that extra 10% of adrenaline, like we saw with Carlos Rodon the other night, the last pitch he threw in that no-hitter was 98.8 miles per hour, the fastest of his lifetime, because he had the extra adrenaline in that situation. And Fernando Tatis Jr. playing against the Dodgers, being excited, you know, facing a Dodgers reliever late in the game with the game on the line, and you throw in that extra 10%, you wonder if his body is going to hold up.
I'd worry. And I'd worry about, look, all of a sudden he dives, you know, and that shoulder,
he
just lands on it awkwardly. I mean, it's going to be one of those where, God forbid, but you do worry, like one of those moments where he makes the play and all of a sudden you watch the ball being thrown to first, or you watch the ball, you know, going over the shortstop's head. And the next image you see is you look back to see where he is and he's laying on the ground in the hole, or he's laying on the ground at home plate. You're like, what happened?
All right. Speaking of young players, let's talk about the growth of a couple of other young players who are thriving so far. Ronald Acuña Jr. has gotten to the point, Carl, where it's starting to remind me, you know, I grew up a huge Dodger fan. In 1981, every time that Fernando Valenzuela took the mound, it was like, oh my God, he did it again. You know, you'd follow the game. You'd get the updates. Dodgers are leading 3-0 in the sixth inning. And you're like, he's doing it again. Ronald Acuña Jr. in these first days of this season, he comes to the plate and you just, you know, you either you're watching the game or you get the updates and you're like, oh my God, he did it again. He's hitting .442. He's got a .492 on base percentage. He has an OPS of .1492. He's got 14 extra base hits in 13 games. He scored 17 runs in 13 games, 6 walks, 9 strikeouts. He has absolutely taken his game to the next level.
He has. And, you know, when you do watch him, anytime you're more disappointed or surprised when somebody makes an out in this game than when they get a hit, you know you've gone to a level that nobody else really goes to. And that's the way it is with him. I mean, you talk about expectations that he's put on himself. Think about it. You watch him, he comes up with a guy on or two men on, and he makes an out, and you're like, what's wrong? Because you're so used to seeing him hit it hard and hit it for extra bases that when it doesn't happen, you're absolutely right. You're surprised. But look, I remember talking with Brian, you know, early in the season, because we did Braves real early, and Acuña, he cut his hair all off, which was a bit of a surprise. He didn't have a really great spring. And as a veteran baseball player and manager and guy that's been around for a long time said, look, I lose sleep over a lot of things. Ronald Acuña is not one of them. And it's proven to be correct. But he's going to run into a string of 50-50. I think he's got that ability. He certainly is an exciting, you know, guy to have on your team. And I had him as my MVP last year and jumped off this year and thought Corey Seager was my MVP. But look, the idea that he's on that very, very short list, and I had him above Mookie Betts and everyone else last year, he's doing what I knew he was capable of doing. He's fantastic.
You know this, if you have a 1-to-1 ratio of extra base hits to strikeouts, that's incredible.
Right.
And he's got 14 extra base hits and 9 strikeouts. It's unbelievable the damage that he's doing. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., same thing, off to a great start. And I'm just really happy because you and I were there in the Home Run Derby when he put on that show. You know, I remember going into that, there was some sort of grumbling among the veteran players, like, why is this kid, you know, being invited in this event? You know, he hasn't really done that much. I want to say he had 8 home runs in his career at that point. And then the show he put on, you realize, man, this guy has got some serious bat to ball skills. But we all kind of wondered, you know, would he be able to, you know, get ahead of his conditioning? He worked like crazy in the offseason. So far this year, 19 for 46, batting over .400, 3 doubles, 3 homers, 9 walks, 10 strikeouts, and OPS of .1200.
changed his body and also changed his launch angle a little bit. So he is now elevating the ball. He hits it as hard as anybody in the game. He's in that Pete Alonso, Giancarlo Stanton, Aaron Judge conversation and category. We saw Bichette with a walk-off the other day. We saw him hit two balls yesterday over 100-plus miles an hour. Really good to see. Got a terrible call strike against him in the last inning yesterday and then swung at a ball way outside the strike zone. It bounced and he was out on strikes. But as people work hard and put effort in, there's nothing greater than seeing the reward. He's seeing it. And when he steps into the batter's box, the ball explodes off a bat, and he is that different sound guy. And I agree with you. I'm real happy for him. And just to go back to your first point, for the grumbling of the veteran player who wondered about why somebody, you know, so young who hasn't proven himself was in the home run derby, stop. And if you're the veteran player that's grumbling, get your veteran players to get into the derby so a door doesn't open for somebody younger.
Exactly. Yankees and Rays play tonight. I live here in New York, and people are asking the question, are the Rays going to retaliate for what happened with Austin Meadows and others getting pitched inside and hit last week? And I feel like, Carl, when we talk about Rays and Yankees, Rays and Red Sox, we already know the answer. The answer is going to be yes, because, this is the little brother and big brother, and the little brother in this case being the Rays, because they don't have the resources of the Yankees. They're not going to let themselves get pushed around, and they will always punch back, and they always have since they came to creation.
Yeah, why wouldn't they? But so you live in New York, and they're wondering about, will the Rays retaliate? Does that question come before or after, are the Yankees going to be okay? Which this early in the season, I'm surprised at how many are wondering that. And when they see cracks within the Yankees, meaning, you know, shortstop struggles, Jay Bruce at first base, kind of forgotten about Luke Voit, how great he was last year, starting rotation after Cole questions, and here come the Rays who seem to have, like, if you just took the questions that they ask about the Yankees and ask them about the Rays, the answers for the Rays generally are going to be in the positive. They have Adames, who's a great shortstop, a kid who may be even better coming up. They don't generally worry about first base because they know they have guys that are going to get healthy and come back. And their starting staff, in spite of the fact that they lost two really good pitchers last year, is performing well with a bullpen that you have no worries about. So maybe it's almost mixed sort of anxiety about the Rays because, A, they're really good, and of course they're going to retaliate. That's what this series is about. But you want that. I love that. You want to have those types of dynamics exist. Gosh, you know, I grew up in New England. The Detroit Pistons, the Philadelphia 76ers, the Celtics, they didn't play against each other. They fought against each other, and they mixed in some play. That's what you want. You know, you don't literally need fisticuffs, but you want that edge. You want that anxiety. I do. I'm into it. All of a sudden, somebody gets plunked in the fourth inning, and you're like, here we go. God, that's a hell of a lot better than an 8-0 game.
Yeah, the hate meter tonight in some of these series, with Dodgers and Padres, I think they absolutely don't like each other. I think the Dodgers find the Padres just, you read between the lines of what some of the Dodgers are saying, it's almost like, hey, guys, you know what? Why don't you accomplish something before you start yapping? the Padres clearly are coming for what they have. And we saw the Rays last year with everything going on with Chapman, how much they absolutely love sticking it to the big brother.
To me, it's the beauty of sports. Why wouldn't you? You're the Tampa Bay Rays, and you've been clawing and fighting. And last year, you get to a series, and it's a pandemic season, and there's 60 games, so we're just not going to really count it, even though it's a series. And by the way, you lost. Look, there is credibility all around the Rays organization. They've lost front office executives like leaves off a tree in late fall, and yet they continue to adhere to this system. We saw the other night, you know, Kevin Cash starts a kid that we haven't seen because he's been hurt, throws, I think it was 21 pitches in two perfect innings, and you're coming out of the game. It doesn't matter. Like, this is, let me just check. Nope. Okay. Two innings done. And he was done. And you're like, oh my God. It wasn't even like he had stressed himself. There was no sweat involved. This was against a really good team. And nope, done, takes them out. And it works. and it's frustrating, and it drives people crazy. And they're not spending the money we are. How the hell are they winning? And the Dodgers and Padres, I can't wait for this series. I think it's going to be great. And then again, we have them the following weekend. They're really good. I think the difference between the Yankees-Rays series and the Dodgers-Padres is the Padres have now paid players whose names you recognize. And the Rays, in spite of getting to the World Series, Austin Meadows, Kevin Kiermaier, Willie Adames, they don't resonate like Machado, like Tatis, like Snell, like Darvish. So that's the only difference between the four teams, is that the Yankees, Dodgers, and Padres, you know everybody's name. The Rays keep showing up, crashing the party. They play as well as any one of those three teams, but you still don't really know them.
All right, you are well attuned to the machinations of Central Baseball, and I talked on the podcast earlier in the week about that, you know, the blown replay call on Sunday Night Baseball with the Phillies and the Braves, and I you know, tweeted out on Monday morning, like, it's time for Major League Baseball, put out a statement saying we blew that call, and we're going to try to do better going forward. And part of the reason why, Carl, I really think it's important is because the whole sport is built on failure. You know, we see pitchers every day get knocked. Patrick Corbin last night was terrible. And I'm assuming he went and talked to reporters after the game. Hitters, you know, the best hitters, fail 7 out of 10 times. They're used to accountability. And so when you have a situation like on Sunday night, where it was pretty clear that the replay was mistaken, the replay decision was mistaken, I think it only adds to the credibility of the whole system for Major League Baseball if when mistakes are made. And mistakes are going to be made, for all of us, I think it only adds and helps. And that's why I was surprised they didn't say anything like we've seen and the NBA do and we've seen with the NFL. What did you think about that?
I think that Major League Baseball struggles, obviously, with certain things and transparency. And this is a great example, because there appears to be a clear reluctance to acknowledge a mistake when your mistake comes not from your initial reaction, which was, I'm calling him safe, and I believe he was really out, but it comes from the fact that you're reviewing something using so many different camera angles and coming up with the same conclusion, which doesn't make sense. And what I said that night was, if in fact there is a view that Major League Baseball officials have that we, the consumer, the most important part of all this, don't have, the viewer, don't have, you've got to share with us what that view is, because you have a skeptical, now, as you said, an audience that wonders about the credibility of the entire system. That's in question. You've got to be transparent. The whole point of instant replay was to be transparent. Here you go. Here's what we saw. We're getting it right. And then you have a situation where what television is showing may be different than what you're looking at. You've got to change that. I understand that you have more angles. Somehow you've got to make that available, or an explanation has got to be given by an umpire using a microphone at a field or even in New York. Hey, we have this angle. We'll post it later. I don't care, but it is definitive. You've got to remove any of that ambiguity. And all that did that night was present the ambiguity.
You're exactly right. And I do think, and it's funny, you talked about the reluctance to potentially to overturn others. We got a little bit of insight into that yesterday in the Red Sox game against the Twins. Jordan Baker was the home plate umpire. There was a swing. He ruled a foul tip. It was really clear on replay. I mean, absolutely crystal clear that the hitter missed the ball by 6 inches on a path of his swing. Yeah. Alex Cora came out, and Jordan Baker said to him, and the field might caught this, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said in so many words, no one's going to, overturn my call. Yep. And you're just like, what difference does that make? How about just focusing on getting the call right? And go talk to your three colleagues on the field and ask them if they saw something different, and focus on getting the call right. And if they meet and the other three umpires say, I didn't see it, that's fine. But how about just getting the call right?
Right. Or it leads you down the path of, is there some type of conspiracy here where there's an unwritten agreement between us That's something that we will not overrule. It doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. We've all agreed prior to this, we're not going to overturn that. So it's not even worth the conversation. To your point, I heard, I think it was Paul Severino calling the Marlins game. Mattingly got thrown out the other night. I couldn't believe a call. And replay, to me, proved that he was correct. And I heard Severino on the broadcast say a few minutes after, so Major League Baseball has reached out to us and told us that, you know, through editing and through a compilation of video that they had access to, it allowed them to make the decision. And again, it sort of reemphasized my point from the Braves game. If you have access to it, it's wonderful for you to now sort of get a message to the broadcaster that we saw something you didn't. That's not good enough. That doesn't mean anything to me.
Nope.
Because I didn't see it. So you haven't proven anything to me, and I'm worried about the credibility.
I agree. You know, the other night when during that game, and I was getting feedback from Major League Baseball, and they were like, well, there's no evidence to that conclusively says that he didn't touch home plate, which to me was the height of bureaucracy speak. I'm like, no, show me an angle where you can actually say that he did touch home plate, because that doesn't exist. Exactly. Anyway,
I'm with you,
Carl. Thanks for doing this. I always love talking with you.
Be good, bud. Bye-bye.
Bob Kendrick is the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. And Bob, I wanted to have you on this week, and which we're selling celebrating Jackie Robinson Day, because you're the best storyteller. You have the greatest stories. But I first want to ask you, because we were talking before we got started today, about beer. Tell me about that.
Yeah, earlier this week, we partnered with Boulevard Brewing Company to create a special collector's edition beer called Tip Your Cap. And Buster, it was inspired by our incredible viral Tip Your Cap to the Negro Leagues campaign last year as part of the 100th anniversary celebration, where we had all these legendary dignitaries, including four U.S. presidents, along with Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Billie Jean King, all tipped their cap in salute to the Negro Leagues. And as you well know, in our sport, there's no greater show of respect that a baseball player can ever extend than just a simple tip of the cap. We had no idea this thing would take off and go viral. And when we launched that campaign last year, we launched it with President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, and President Jimmy Carter, all tipping their cap, along with that other list of folks that I rattle off. And this inspired the local brewery, which has national footprint in Boulevard, to say, hey, let's collaborate on a beer, baseball beer, and roll it out. And it comes out in May with a portion of the proceeds coming back to support the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
That's really cool. And I'll be, you said it was going to be the beers in, what'd you say, 45 states?
45 different states. So there's a good possibility that it'll be in some place, you know, in your proximity. And so please pick that product up, raise one up, and then help support the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum when you do so.
Well, I know this. Folks in my home state of Vermont will not turn down beer, so I'm sure it'll be there. Absolutely. All right, so I wanted to get your three favorite stories about Jackie Robinson. What's number one?
Well, number one is the classic story that Buck O'Neill oftentimes told, the late, great John Buck O'Neill, and it was alluded to in the film 42 as well. And the story was told to Buck by Hilton Smith. Hilton Smith, Buster, Hall of Fame pitcher for the Kansas City Monarchs. Great pitcher. As a matter of fact, Buck O'Neill says the greatest curveball he's ever seen. And the legendary Monty Irvin would go on to say that you could know Hilton Smith's curveball was coming, and the break on it was so sharp that you couldn't hit it. And so Hilton Smith told Buck this story because Buck was in the Navy when Jackie's playing here for the Kansas City Monarchs. But as the story goes, Buck said they'd been going to a service station in Oklahoma, a small town in Oklahoma, for years. And they had never used the restroom because the sign on the door said for white men only. Well, this is Jackie's first trip into this Oklahoma town. And so the Monarchs pull up the bus to the gas tank. The attendant greets them, puts the hose in the tank. Oh, you boys played a great game, filled up the ballpark as you normally do. Jackie gets off the bus and he starts walking toward the restroom. The attendant says, boy, where you going? Jackie says, I'm going to the restroom. He says, boy, you know you can't go to that restroom. Jackie says, take the hose out the tank. Now, the man thought that for a minute because Buster the Monarch's got a 50-gallon tank on one side. They've got a 50-gallon tank on the other side of the bus. He's not going to sell that much gas to any single customer until they came back in town. You know what the attendant said? He said, you boys go to the restroom, but don't stay long. And for Buck, it was, I think, a great indication of just how different Jackie was. Yeah, Jackie was different than they were. They had been acclimated to segregation, but not Jackie. And what Jackie was trying to help them understand, even in 1945, even in the midst of Jim Crow, that you're taking some things that you don't necessarily have to take. Yeah, that was Jackie. And Buck always delighted in telling that story. The other story also involves Buck O'Neill. And this is while Buck is in the Navy, when the news breaks that Branch Rickey had signed Jackie to an organized contract. And Buck is in Subic Bay, Philippines, serving in World War II. And the news flashes, and Buck O'Neill says he gets up that night and he grabs the megaphone from the sergeant, and he gets on the horn, as he would say, now hear this, now hear this. Branch Rickey has signed Jackie Robinson to an organized contract. And as he said, they hooped, they hollered, they shot their guns. Very few of them got any sleep that night. So again, for me, you hear these stories of the animosity of Negro League players who felt maybe like they were slighted. That wasn't true. That wasn't true. Now, there may have been some who had lamented that they were beyond their prime and they wouldn't get that opportunity. But by and large, these players were not jealous of Jackie. They were as excited as everybody else. And particularly in the African-American community, you know, one of the things that we talk about is that Jackie Robinson's breaking of the color barrier buster was equivalent to the first man landing on the moon in the Black community. It was complete euphoria. And by and large, the players were very supportive. Like I said, some of them may have been upset because this happened beyond their prime. Now, Satchel was a little bit bitter because Satchel was, in many respects, the Negro League's. He was the Negro League's biggest star. He drew the biggest crowds. But it was so easy for the other owners to say, no, Satchel, you're too old. You're too old. We can't bring you. And it's also too much risk. In a pitcher, and particularly an old pitcher, that he might fail. And as you well know, the first guy cannot fail.
Can't fail.
First guy can't fail. If the first guy fails, there is no second guy. And so they dismissed Satchel. And I think Satchel was a little hurt about that. And Buck always surmised that had Satchel been chosen, he would not have gone through nearly as much hatred as Jackie did, because Satchel was a big, big star. Everybody knew who Satchel Paige was. Yeah, Jackie was still a relative unknown as it related to baseball. He hadn't played much baseball, even though he was a letterman at UCLA. He didn't play a lot of baseball. Really, his season here in Kansas City was his first professional season at any level, and he had a great season, but he didn't have a lot of baseball under his belt to draw from. But he was such an extraordinary athlete that he caught on very quickly, and he took that Negro League style of play with him. And the other thing that I'm reminded of, Buster, is how Jackie got to the Monarchs. Yeah, Jackie tries out for the Monarchs in Houston, Texas. And again, Hilton Smith had seen Jackie playing baseball at Fort Hood. Hilton Smith was from Texas, and he had seen Jackie playing baseball over at Fort Hood. And he suggests to the Monarchs owner, J.O. Wilkinson, that here's a guy that you might want to take a look at, because really the Monarchs roster had been decimated by World War II. Yeah, Buck is serving in the Navy. The great Henry Thompson. Henry Thompson holds the distinction of being the only player to break two major league teams' color barriers. So he breaks the color barrier with the St. Louis Browns, and then he re-breaks the color barrier with the New York Giants. That's how good Henry Thompson was. Had it not been for Henry Thompson's own personal demons, I think Henry Thompson had Hall of Fame capability. He had a Hall of Fame pedigree. And so he's in the Army. A guy named Ted Strong. Ted Strong, Buster, thank Dave Winfield. Before we knew who Dave Winfield was. Ted Strong, man, 6'7" tall, freakish athlete, played every position except for pitch and catch. He's a 6'7" shortstop. Starred for the Harlem Globetrotters. Not just played for the Harlem Globetrotters, but starred for the Harlem Globetrotters. He's in the Army. And the great Willard Brown. Willard Brown was nicknamed Home Run Brown by Josh Gibson. Now, if Josh Gibson calls you home run, then you must have some power. And Willard Brown was a five-tool, do-it-all guy with tremendous power. In Puerto Rico, they nicknamed him Ese Hombre, that man, because he won the Triple Crown in Puerto Rico twice. He was as beloved in Puerto Rico as the great Roberto Clemente, particularly by the older Puerto Rican baseball fan. He's in the Army. Quite frankly, Buster, if the Monarchs have their full contingent of players, Jackie never gets invited to try out.
Wow.
Yeah, and how would history have been altered? And so Jackie makes the team. He comes to Kansas City, has a really good season, makes the East-West All-Star game, and then he disappears. He's gone. His teammates had no idea where he was. And as we know, he was meeting with Branch Rickey, and the two of them make this epic decision that he's going to be the chosen one to break baseball's six-decade-long self-imposed color barrier. But the irony of all of this is that little did J.L. Wilkinson know, J.L. Wilkinson owned the Kansas City Monarchs, that he had signed the man that was going to put him out of business.
Wow.
Yeah, because once Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier, it's not a matter of if. It's simply a matter of when the Negro Leagues were going to fold. And J.L. Wilkinson sold his business interest to his partner, T.Y. Baird, the year after Jackie breaks the color barrier, because he knows now that the business of Black baseball is about to die.
That's exactly right. What was it? Leo DeRocher, when he heard about that petition that the players were putting together with the Brooklyn Dodgers in the spring of 1947, he said to the players, basically, you can stick that petition where the sun doesn't shine. And the other thing, too, is, God, let me tell you, folks, he's only the first. He's the first.
Yeah, and they're coming. Coming now.
Exactly. All right, Bob, you are the best storyteller. I always love talking with you. Thank you.
Buster, man, it's my pleasure. Thank you. It's great to see you. And hopefully we'll see you sometime soon in Kansas City.
I would love that. Bob Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how are you doing this week?
Buster, I am fine. Jackie Robinson week. The season is moving along. Spring is in the air. So we're doing well.
Yeah, we just got done talking with Bob Kendrick, and you know, there's that great logo from the first Jackie Robinson event, which was in 1997. I was at the New York Times covering the Mets that year, April 15th, and that logo was done by my good friend Todd Radom.
Yeah, absolutely. What a special thing to have been involved with, to have been there that night at Shea Stadium with the President of the United States and Mrs. Robinson there, and a piece of history. And Buster, I remember, as an invited guest, sitting in a suite at Shea Stadium surrounded by these Negro Leagues players. And again, that's 24 years ago. So, you know, history moves on, and just really just feeling like I was surrounded by amazingness that evening. And what a great evening to celebrate.
All right. It's hard to say who's more dominant in 2020, the Dodgers or me, in the weekly quiz. We'll get to that in a second as I, you know, look to continue my winning ways. But first, we're going to talk about a forgotten franchise, from Kansas City.
That's right, Buster. Kansas City has been an American League town for all but one season since 1955. But before the Royals and before the Athletics, there were the Kansas City Cowboys, members of the National League for one single campaign in 1886. Kansas City was admitted to the National League on February 17th of that year, and they opened up at home on April 30th. Talk about a short runway. And that day they dropped a 6-5 decision in 13 innings to Chicago, which are today known as the Chicago Cubs. The Cowboys played their home games at 3,500-seat Association Park, a.k.a. The Hole. So just imagine the intimidation factor of a team coming to visit The Hole. And why did they call it that? The ballpark had a dirt playing surface, and it was sunken about 10 feet below sea level. It stood on what's now the Paseo's on-ramp for Interstates 29 and 35. A lot of flooding there. Not the best quality field in the history of the majors. By any measure, KC's lone season was pretty awful, too. Their best player was probably second baseman Al Myers, who hit for a .277 average and drove in 51 runs. At the other end of the spectrum, Buster, their pitching was abysmal. Righty pitcher Stump Wiedemann led the league with 36 losses, although, Buster, he did pitch 48 complete games.
Wow.
Not going to see that in 2021. The team and their fans had a reputation for rowdiness, and this did not endear them to visiting players or umpires. And when the smoke cleared, the Cowboys finished the season with a record of 30 wins and 91 losses, which was good for seventh place in the eight-team National League, a whopping 58.5 games out of first. This team folded just prior to the start of the 1887 National League season. They were forced to sell their players back to the league for $6,000. And as is the case so often in life, one door closed and another opened as Kansas City was effectively replaced by Pittsburgh, the club that plays today as the Pittsburgh Pirates. And so, Buster, ends the brief sad tale of this week's forgotten franchise, the Kansas City Cowboys.
The Hole. I don't think our good friend Dave Meller, who is the head of grounds at Fenway Park, would probably have approved the playing surface that The Hole was. Can you imagine how ugly that was? Like, if you were an infielder, you're probably catching balls off your teeth every day.
Yeah, yeah. And I, if I'm not mistaken, ballpark was hastily constructed, which was not unusual back then. And, to your point also, Buster, can you imagine road trips to Kansas City, the far distant West in 1886? You know, quite an undertaking. And I think that that's one of the reasons why Kansas City did not get another major league franchise for quite some time. But they have one. The Royals are here to stay. But they should have a Cowboys night, a whole night at Kauffman Stadium.
I'll have to reach out to my good friend Mike Swanson, media relations with the Royals, to see if that's something that they've done or talked about doing at some point. All right, let's get to this week's quiz. What's my winning streak up to, 30 or 40? I can't remember.
Oh, Taylor, you Buster. Need to. With this kind of trash talk? Come on. The gauntlet is laid down. All right, here is this week's question, gentlemen. This Hall of Famer played the most seasons without ever having appeared in a World Series. Was it Harold Baines, Ken Griffey Jr., Frank Thomas, or Phil Niekro? Most seasons without ever having appeared in a World Series.
Wow. Go ahead, Taylor.
Let's go Frank Thomas, just because I see him on those weird commercials all the time.
Wow. Well, that's definitely not the answer. Now, the question is, which of the two? Run through them again for me, Todd.
Harold Baines, Ken Griffey Jr., Frank Thomas, or Phil Niekro?
Yeah, I'm going to go Phil Niekro.
Buster, you are correct.
I mean, this is a rout, okay? My goodness. This is an absolute rout.
Phil Niekro with 24 major league seasons and no World Series. Ken Griffey Jr. and Harold Baines with 22. Frank Thomas with a mere 19, but holy smokes, guys.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, this is...
Taylor getting ready to fire the manager or something.
I'm going back to bed. This is ridiculous.
Wow.
All right, Todd, you have, your segment is the best of the week. I love your questions. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you, guys. It was a pleasure talking about the Kansas City Cowboys. Have a good weekend.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a fine Friday. First up, we have Amy Chapman at Amy R. Chapman. She writes in, the interview with Brian Helgeland was incredible. When Henry Aaron was mentioned, it made me wonder when his life would become a movie. What other baseball players do you think should have their lives put on screen? Great question, Amy.
Wow. He would be a great one. And of course, you would have to have adversity. You know, I've often wondered about El Duque, the longtime pitcher for the New York Yankees and other teams, whether or not, you know, having left Cuba and, you know, struggled when he came over and everything that he went through and making that journey, he would have been someone who I would have been really cool to see a movie made about him. I've wondered about Josh Hamilton. You know, he had an incredible trajectory in his life with things that he's gone through. But I suspect that recent events means that probably that's not going to happen.
All right. Last question for the week. We have Mr. Jakey RS at JakeyYRS79. He writes in, my wife asked me a question that I couldn't answer, so I turned to you. What equipment is provided by the player and what is provided by the team as tools for the job? Interesting question, Jake.
Yeah. So teams, Mr. Jakey, will provide the bats. In other words, they'll order the bats for the players. You do see like glove representatives, batting glove representatives who will hang out, outside the clubhouse. They'll be around. They'll have conversations with players. They'll get feedback. We talked to Francisco Lindor about all those gloves that he has. You know, he's got a deal where he can get all kinds of gloves. Other players just like one glove and they don't actually do a lot of that stuff. But some of the equipment, the bats are ordered by the players, by the teams on behalf of the players. But most of the other equipment, I think, it comes on an individual basis with the players and the people that they have their marketing deals with.
That makes sense. All right. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Great week of podcasting. And please follow and rate and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
That's it for today. And thanks to Carl, Bob, Todd, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something that we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.